Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, here with Executive Director Joshua to hit some of the highlights that we've seen in the marriage and family space over the last week or so. But we always begin a bit with some Bible time. And I am in the New Testament these days. I'm a bit of a prophet junkie. I like cannot get enough of Isaiah and Jeremiah and Nehemiah, but I was like, it is time to come back to AD. So I'm working my way through 1st and 2nd Peter, which if I had favorite books of the New Testament, it would probably be the Peters, mainly because I just think that it is the culture war manual. It is the book, that tell you how to live in a hostile culture. And one verse stood out to me this morning while I was reading. I have this online commentary called Enduring Word. It's awesome because it kind of pulls together historical context, other extra biblical and biblical context, different cross references. But then, you know, commentators like Clark and Spurgeon and some of the great Christian thinkers and what they've said about the various verses. So I try to read through the commentary on each chapter and I always learn something. But this very bare bones basic verse stood out to me today as just sort of a guiding light for any of us who wants to try to swim upstream, a culture that is pushing you away from Christ, away from truth, and away from the protection of children. This is something that I just think I need to keep front and center for me all the time. And it's 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 12. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. So what are they saying? There's probably going to be something where you make them angry. There's going to be something where you offend their cultural norms. There's going to be something where you run afoul of their gods. And he's not saying avoid that thing. He is saying, make sure that your behavior is so beautiful that when they get angry at you for that thing, they cannot look back and say, oh, and she's also a liar. Oh, and he also is a hypocrite. Oh, and she also doesn't know how to be a good mom to her own kids. Oh, and he also doesn't take care of his own family. Your conduct needs to be so excellent that the only thing they can hate on is that one thing that you will not go along with to get along with. So that is this crazy, strange paradox of the Christian life, where your conduct needs to be exemplary, above reproach, and beautiful because your words, your beliefs, and your behaviors will trigger, will run afoul of something that the culture wants to exalt and protect and normalize. So just a great reflection for me, because there's a lot of what we do with Them Before Us that there's a lot of things that we talk about at Them Before Us, which are offensive, that are stumbling blocks to the culture, even to some people who call themselves Christians. Some of the things that we talk about, which is avoiding divorce when there's no abuse or no adultery, or rejecting reproductive technologies that victimize children, or publicly proclaiming that gay marriage victimizes children. There's so many things at Them Before Us, so many beliefs, so many policies that we're going to advocate for that are going to enrage the culture around us. Let them be enraged, but never because of our conduct, never because we have failed to be beautiful in our own lives or in the way we're communicating those challenging truths. Josh, I'm going to bring you in here. You too are a culture warrior in your own right, a little nicer than me sometimes, I would say. So maybe you have some insight into executing this verse that I need to learn from.
It reminds me of the passage that talks about walk worthy of the calling you've received. I do think there is a level of, you know, not marking your success by the lack of resistance. You know, we need to understand that the way that we live our life and the things we stand for do bring about resistance. That's not the bad thing. It's the idea of being a peacemaker, not a peacekeeper. But I think you're right. It's just being prepared. knowing that when the world comes after you, don't give them any room. Don't give them anything to pick at, because they're perfectly fine with finding other reasons to disqualify you with the purpose of silencing your voice on, you know, that gospel truth that you might be, regardless of your other failings, regardless of your other shortcomings, you may be dead on that one thing. But if they can find a way to discredit you, they will. The culture will. I mean, Katie, how many times have we seen that with pastors who it's difficult? They're doing so many great things. They may be leading great ministries, but they have a drinking problem, or it comes out that they've struggled with sexual addiction, or and you're like, man, the devil will take any foothold he can in your life to try to overthrow all the good that God's trying to do through your life. And again, we're none of us are immune to these things. And no one's saying it has to be flawless. It's only through the power of the Holy Spirit that we're able to, you know, live to walk worthy. But I think it's a shedding your naivety to know, because of the thing God wants to do through my life, because of the battles he's called me to fight in the culture, because of who he's called me to protect or advocate for, I need to be on my guard with my family, with my personal life, with what I click, watch, consume, and purchase, because those around me are absolutely waiting, you know, like the tiger crouching behind the door, like the lion crouching, and they're waiting on you because they want nothing more than to be able to take down another pillar in the Christian community.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you must master it. You know, every single one of us has something where it could master us. Maybe it's a spending problem. Maybe it's a lust problem. Maybe it is, you know, like me, worried more about what people think about me than what God thinks about me. That's more my temptation. And all of us have something where we have to make a choice. It's going to master us, or we're going to master it through the power of the Holy Spirit. And it's the ordinary things, you know, a lot of us that have been walking with the Lord for a long time, we have to win those battles in smaller things. I wanted to turn our attention to an announcement that garnered a lot of attention on social media, something that might have looked like a small thing, but a lot of people called out as, nope, that's actually a big thing. And it was this public divorce announcement by Frankie Muniz. And I just looked at the pictures. I'm like, okay, race car driver. But he's actually the star of the show, Malcolm in the Middle, that was like my show to watch with my third kid for the longest time. So like, we know all the Malcolm in the Middle lore. I was really, really sad when I saw this. And here's the full story. So Frankie has been married for 10 years, and he makes this very public announcement about his divorce. Now, right before this, sweet, we're going to co-parent, I'm going to read some of it for you. He had actually shared a video of he and his wife dancing in what's very clearly like a mansion home, right? Where they're dancing from up top. You can see sort of a chandelier, and they're doing like the Running Man, and his wife, they're celebrating. They're like, hey, what the dance you do when your divorce is final. And they're just having a big party, right? Like, we're both so happy. We're on the same page. And then it's so sad in the video. Their kid runs in, their kid who's like 5 or 6. He starts dancing with them, because what do kids want most? They want to be in the middle of the joy and the love between their own mom and dad. And so what he saw is his mother and father loving each other. And he thought, this is an opportunity. This is the only thing I want. Nothing is going to make me happier than being a part of a celebration where my mom and dad are enjoying each other. Little did he know that he was dancing along to the demise of his home, to the death of the one place where he shares the love of his mother and father every day. So then Frankie posts.
Honestly, that's just sick right there. I know there's more to share, but the visual picture, and this happens anytime I'm wrestling with a kid, another kid wants to come and join in. Anytime Corinne and I are wrestling or you know, we're being playful around the kids, one of them comes to rescue her or to try to get a hug from me. It's you're right. It's so, they aren't thinking about that. If they really felt competition, they wouldn't come get in the middle, right? If we were playing, they don't feel competition. They feel that me loving her is reflecting on them, and they are receiving it and want to be a part of it. And they know their place is right in the middle. So the sick picture of trying to join in the dance because the child doesn't understand that for content, they're creating a divorce dance is brutal. I mean, imagine 20 years from now when this kid watches this stupid video and realizes I was a prop in your video that was the death of my family. This is the reason I spent alternating weekends. This is the reason I had to hang out with your new boyfriend, Mom. Like that's the stuff he's going to think. I know he deleted it. Good. I'm glad he felt some shame over it, but gosh, that right there is just like a sad, sad picture for that kid.
He ended up deleting the video because after he posted this, he maybe got some heat from it. And so then he like covered, right? So then he created his new post. Life update. Following a period of separation that we've kept private, Paige and I have decided to move forward with ending our marriage. After 10 beautiful years together, we've grown in ways that made us realize our relationship feels more the most natural and strong and deep as a friendship, as co-parents. We share an incredible son who remains the center of our world, and we're both happier, stronger parents because of the love and growth we've shared. We're going to continue to like work in partnership, and we're so grateful, and we're going to be racing together, and there's going to be teamwork. And I will tell you what surprised me about this announcement. Everybody was like, this is not it. This is not it. And, you know, when I started Them Before Us in 2018, critiquing divorce wasn't really a thing. But 8 years later, I think people have felt emboldened, and there's been enough education around the harms of divorce that people are like, no, this isn't just a new chapter. No, you're not going to have the same teamwork. You're not going to be able to co-parent if you're not co-resident with your son. And all I saw, the comments after that is like, no, you actually have to fight for your marriage. Frankie, nope, you actually don't get to throw in the towel. Nope, you don't get to pretend like this is a celebration when your son is going to pay the price. Like, there was a lot of backlash to this announcement. That actually surprised me and encouraged me.
Well, you know, when they said that one word, he remains the center, that is physically impossible when you get a divorce. If two people have the child at the center, then they are going to make the decisions that center, that prioritize the child. By definition, when two people in a marriage, it is literally the fruit of what you create. It does live inside of your relationship. It is the context. It's a fusion of the two people. I mean, there's in so many ways, it is the center. When you divorce and create two separate entities, it becomes impossible for the child to be centered in the same way. Even if you both make them priority number one, the fact that there are now two people with two new priority number ones and not a shared common goal in the same place, I'm convinced there's absolutely no way for two people to get a divorce that does not cause the child to have to make sacrifices on behalf of the adults. It is impossible. You can say the child will remain the priority. What you are doing will require sacrifice. Now, we say often, divorce is sometimes necessary, but it is always a tragedy. It is never to be celebrated. Like I'm the child of a divorce. I know you are as well, Katie. Sometimes you can say, wow, that was an unsafe situation. I am glad me and my children are out of it. But no one would ever say, I'm glad it turned out this way. This is what I was envisioning on the day I got married. You may say you hope the other person would have acted differently. Maybe you were the hero in the situation that acted, you know, heroically to try to keep it together. But I don't know any of these, you know, posts where they're talking about this in such flowery language. It does kind of belie this narrative of, no, nothing was wrong. We're doing really great. And we believe we can really give the kid everything they need from our completely new separate lives, potentially with new partners. And that's what I think was so jarring to people, is like, this isn't what I know divorce to be.
I think you're exactly right. There is no way for the child to be the center. And it's very clear he was not the center of this decision. The only thing that was the center was whatever romantic or sexual aims that the adults had that were not being met or that they wanted to direct elsewhere. And that forced the child to pay the price. It forced the child to be decentered in the relationship that made him, so that now new romantic goals for the adults can be central. Stay with us. We're going to be right back. We're going to cover some of what we've seen in the news, including the Supreme Court decision from last week.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
We're back at Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, here with Executive Director of Them Before Us, Josh Wood. And I wanted to turn our attention towards the Supreme Court's decision. Man, they went out with a bang. They had some major decisions handed down before they recessed. And one of them was this decision to allow states to protect girls' sports. So, Josh, you want to tell us a little bit about what they ruled and what it means?
The Supreme Court ruled last week that states have the constitutional authority to reserve. So this isn't necessarily a mandate as I'm reading it, but that states can. They have the authority to reserve women's and girls' sports for biological females, upholding laws in Idaho and West Virginia. And the opinion was authored by Kavanaugh. It doesn't mandate, like I said earlier, sex-based teams. It is just simply confirming that a state gets the right to choose what that means to them. So, we could say the biggest win would be the Supreme Court saying what a female means, what a male means. But they didn't, as far as I'm understanding it, they didn't go that far. But I do think it's a huge win. And what I am seeing is we are moving back, it feels like, away from the transgender craze to banning these procedures. We've started to see clinics having to pay kind of these put up these anti-transition or detransition clinics. We're starting to see sports saying the states get to do this. I think it seems like we're moving almost incrementally back to normalcy.
I think we've hit peak trans, and we saw that in culture. We can see it in the polls as it relates to public support for especially transitioning children, but now we're seeing it in the courts too. Now we're seeing that a lot of these states that went first as it relates to saying, you do not get to mandate that we allow boys to play in girls' sports. You do not get to mandate that some of these podium spots are taken by men and not women. They decided they wanted to sue. They were sued. They refused to go along with it. And so what this decision did is it protected the states that said no. No, we cannot have boys playing in girls' sports. No, we are going to prohibit biological men from being in female sports. So great. This was a really big win because the previous administration had tried to use Title IX, which was supposed to be exactly for girls' sports, to say boys have to be in those girls' sports. So for the few states, it was up to about 20, but it was two states in this case specifically that said, no, we're not going along with that. The court said, you don't have to. Now, right after this decision was issued, you had Kristen Wagner, the head of Alliance Defending Freedom, who argued these cases, said, great, I'll tell you what's next. Now we go after every state. Now we're going to say that actually girls everywhere, even in the states that don't have the stones, even in the states that think it's okay for biological boys to steal girls' spots in the pool or on the track or on the field, just because their ideology is warped, they don't get to steal opportunities from girls either. So, you know, we do a lot of policy work at Them Before Us, a lot of work in the realms of defending children's right to life and right to their mother and father. We have a lot of policy recommendations. We get to work with the different people on the state level as it relates to trying to roll back no-fault divorce, trying to fortify the rights of children in the world of big fertility, trying to make sure that children are not bought and sold through surrogacy, spearheading a coalition to overturn gay marriage because it victimizes children. We're in the policy space a lot. And I think that what we've learned is you often don't get the big catch right away, that you do have to go incremental at times. You have to say, what can we do to build a case? What laws can we pass? What policies can we enshrine to start to build the case and work our way up to the point where we say, we're going to completely retake this area on behalf of kids. So this is not a small win. This is a major win, but it's not the end, right? This first win says if states understand that children need protection, that girls need protection in sports, they should be able to protect them. But the ultimate goal is saying whether or not an individual state believes that, girls do deserve protection. So I think that's what's coming up next.
Well, Katie, I'd be interested to know. So what they are, what they had a couple states, Idaho, West Virginia, good on them, who said, when it comes to being a male or being a female, we believe that that is rooted in a biological reality. That's something you can test for. And we don't think that it is up to the individual, the adult, the state bureaucrat to by pronouncement change a biological reality, a fact, or a relationship one has to their own body. I do see a lot of parallels with marriage here, that when it comes to marriage and specifically what our, you know, one of our huge issues with Obergefell, which is the case that legalized same-sex marriage, is that it said that parentage, the assignment of parentage, the recognition of parentage, where a mother and father are recognized by the state to have had a child, that bureaucrats, the Supreme Court, they said that same thing. It's not all that different. They said that this comes with marriage. And so now every state has to assign the same way that we get to say this relationship, that you're not just, you know, coming out of the womb belonging to or with someone, a mother and father, but actually we get to say now that that who you belong with. Now that's a biological reality too. You are a creation of two people. You do belong with your mother and your father. But the states took it upon themselves to say, actually, we think we can actually just assign this child wherever we want, to whomever we want. That seems to me like another fundamental shift of a relationship. So I do wonder, could you see down the pike, you could see a Supreme Court saying something similar, that starting with, we need to establish that it does matter who your mom is. It does matter who your father is. Those are fundamental realities built into your DNA, testable, no different than your gender or your sex, your biological sex.
As I mentioned, and that ties in to exactly what you're saying, Them Before Us is spearheading a national coalition to overturn gay marriage. American Family Radio is a part of that. American Family Association is a part of that. Jenna Ellis, another one of the talk show hosts here, is also a part of that. I mean, we are collecting influencers from the Daily Wire to the Blaze to Newsweek, state family policy leaders, other national organizations. And we are driving at Obergefell, but it's going to take a lot to get there. But I will say that every single time there is a decision that grounds the law, reaffirms the reality that men and women are different, those are the things that are always going to redound to overturning Obergefell. Anytime you touch biological grass, and you say, these two things are not interchangeable, which is exactly what they said in this decision as it relates to women's sports. You cannot just swap in a boy that identifies as a girl. Maybe he's had some hormone therapy. Maybe he's even had surgery. You don't get to swap them in and say, no different. Whenever you say there are fundamental differences between male and female, that a social transition, that a cross-sex hormone regime, that puberty blockers, that mutilating surgeries are never going to change. Male and female are different. Ultimately, you're going to get back to the point where then, where do those differences matter most? Not in the locker room, not in the swimming pool, when it comes to making babies. That is where those differences matter most. And what institution was established to protect the babies that result from those male-female differences? The answer is marriage. So if you go to greaterthancampaign.com, you can look at our coalition and you can see the entire campaign has to do with children. They come from a man and woman. They benefit from that man and woman. Their development is blessed by that man and woman. They love to be loved and they love to see that man and woman loving each other, as we talked about in the last segment. And marriage is the delivery system that nearly every culture has used to provide children with that man and that woman. So we are going to attack this on very similar grounds as these laws that are challenging boys identifying into girls' sports. It doesn't matter what your identity is. It matters what your biology is. And we got that wrong in Obergefell. The court elevated adult identity about the fundamental natural rights of children. So how are we going to go about this? The same way they did with the girls' sports. You emphasize the non-negotiable, irrefutable, undeniable biological differences, And when you acknowledge that, you will get the right policy.
Yeah, the biological identity of the child. It's so funny. I mean, it's not funny, I guess. It's crazy to me that what lawmakers intended for good, right? That when a child's born 100 years ago, you didn't necessarily know who the father was. It was obvious pre-IVF, whoever was pregnant with the child, that was the mother of the child. Again, we've gone through some crazy things with IVF and surrogacy where that's sometimes now split. But that wasn't the case. And so they put in place these laws that said, if the woman is married, we are safe to assume the parentage, that the father is the husband. And so they put in place that, well, it's crazy to me that then the Supreme Court says, oh, well, if you were assuming that the married spouse of the mother, for all intents and purposes, has always been the husband, is the father, then now you have to assume the married spouse, even if it's a woman, is this child's second, scare quotes, mother. It is you can see now, they mandated that in law. If you're doing it for the male who's married to the woman, you do it for the female who's now going to be married to the woman. That is a fundamental denial of a biological reality. That child who comes out has a father. Whether that father is married to the mother who gave birth, that child, you could take their blood test. They have a father. And for us to deny that and to mandate it, that's another crazy part. I don't think a lot of people know the Supreme Court, through the legalization of same-sex marriage, did not give states the option. It did not permit one state to do it. It said anywhere you are doing this for the one, you must now do for the other. And it is now caused a generation to be you know, affirmed in law that, hey, you don't actually have a father. That's essentially what they're saying to them. We decided who your father was, or we decided, and you have two mothers now. And that for me is the same root of a bad tree, of saying the state, the government, the parent gets to now decide that you're actually going to identify as female. You're actually going to identify as the parent of this child. That is an assignment of parent at birth. I'm so glad we're spearheading this campaign, because we do need a return to truth. It does matter who your parents, who your mother and father are.
We often say it then before us that the victim determines the policy. And when you look at the decision to legalize gay marriage, mandate gay marriage across the country, overriding close to three dozen states that said, no, we're going to define marriage as a male and a female union. The reason you get to gay marriage is because gay adults said they were victims. And if those are the victims, then of course the policy is going to wrap around the victims. What we're doing at Them Before Us and at Greater Than Campaign is saying, no, 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 no. Adults who identify as gay are not the victims. Children that lose their mother and father are the victims. Once you realize who the real victims are, you're going to get the right policy. Well, the next thing that I wanted to discuss with you, Josh, is this testimony of a woman named Jessica Gorman, who was before the House Judiciary Subcommittee last week, and her 18-year-old daughter, Sheridan, a Loyola University Chicago freshman, was killed by an illegal immigrant. She was fatally shot in March. And she was arguing, like, my daughter would be alive today if you had actually enforced immigration law. And this is another example of misidentifying the victim, right? The law, or the previous administration especially, but progressivism in general, says, oh, these people that want to be in the country, who are coming from sometimes really desperate, downtrodden places, they're the victims. They're the victims because they need to be in here without any kind of screening, without any kind of like vetting process, receiving very often generous welfare benefits and all kinds of public assistance. They are the victims. But what we heard from this mother was that actually her daughter who was killed was the victim. So, you know, what we're trying to do in the world of marriage and family, which is recenter the victim, it's not adults who don't get what they want. It is children who are denied what they need. Also, I think needs to happen in the immigration debate. It is not adults who are economically desperate or who are criminals that are looking for an exodus from some kind of harsh treatment in their country, or from people that are coming to take advantage of our generous welfare benefits. They are not the victims. The people especially the children and the women who are victimized by sometimes criminal elements, they're the victims. And then I would say actually ordinary citizens who have to shoulder the load of people that are not affiliated, are not assimilating, are not consenting to become part of this American project. Those are the victims. So Josh, you've got a history, you've got a background and a degree as it relates to humanitarian aid, understanding sort of these larger movements of people kind of flowing to different places, sometimes because of really urgent needs. What's your take on this?
Specific to immigration, I think, man, it breaks your heart. I can't imagine losing a child. That beyond the pale, and people who've done that. You can think of a lot of Gold Star families who've lost a child. And it's heartbreaking when they pass away under circumstances of valor and honor, to imagine not only that it was someone breaking the law, but then also to go further, that it was actually a failure to enforce the law by the righteous, you know, magistrates that led to someone being able to break the law and hurt my child. It's just another, again, it like feels like it's escalating, that these types of things are preventable. This person was not here legally. And what kills me, I think, about the current state is we have our adult politicians do not have the ability or the courage right now in the current climate to fix it. It feels like we're completely gridlocked because they're so afraid of who we're going to hurt or upset, and who pays the price for the indecision and the conflict. You can see it. It's the children and ultimately the parents.
Well, hearkening back to our Bible time at the very beginning, we need to keep our behavior excellent because we have to speak out against all different manner of victimization of the innocent. It's our job. It's your job. Let's do it together.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to Here for the Comments, a Them Before Us podcast series where we dive into the comments and the questions that we get online, and we unpack the children's rights perspective we use to answer them. I'm your host, Jen, and I'm joined by Sam, and we are here for the comments. Today, we're talking about kind of some celebrity news that popped off last week, and it's Frankie Muniz, who we know from Malcolm in the Middle, My Dog Skip, which was a terrible movie where the dog dies in the end from old age. Not even traumatic, but my sister and I were sobbing in the car on the way home after that. But he and his wife announced their divorce on social media. And Sam, tell us a little bit what the gist of that post and reaction has been so far.
Yeah, no, the reason why this is so crazy, because I mean, how many Hollywood divorces do we see? Constant. All right. But this one stood out. This one blew up on social media because it was just too flowery of a post, like too sweet, too nice. It's like, this is weird. So like, he starts it off with life update, just to tell everyone. He said, following a period of separation that we kept private, Paige and I have decided to move forward with ending our marriage. After 10 beautiful years together, we've grown in ways that made us realize our relationship feels most natural and strong as a deep friendship and as co-parents. We share an incredible son. We're both happier, stronger parents because of this. But then he goes on and he says, I'm endlessly grateful to Paige for everything she's done for me and our family. She's put her own dreams on hold so I could chase mine. And she was my biggest supporter. And he says how much he respects her and how like they're excited to co-parent together. And it's just like this thing of like, if you love your spouse that much, you shouldn't be getting divorced. If this is such a happy, like, we're just so happy to co-parent together. We're excited about this. And it's like, if you can look at the other person and say, I have so much respect and love for them, then why are you blowing up your children's lives? What are you doing this over? Because it's not because, somebody's cheating and somebody's abusing the other person. This isn't like a safety situation. This is quite literally like just because they have different desires and wants in this moment that don't include their marriage, and they're not thinking about their kid at all. And it's so crazy to me. It drives me crazy, especially the whole like, she's done so much for me and she's put her dreams on hold. And it's like, yeah, she probably did. And she probably gave you children, which is very difficult for women. And like, she went through years of this, and you're not going to remain loyal to her You're not going to take care of her forever? Like, that was the gig. That's the deal with marriage. I will do this for you and you'll take care of me forever. Like, it's supposed to be a mutual thing. So anyway, so a lot of people had a lot to say about that. And you said you saw a video. I didn't see the video, but if you want to explain that too.
Yeah. So I guess initially he posted all of that text with kind of a TikTok reel sort of video of him and his wife doing a choreographed sort of dance, even picking up their kid, throwing the kid in the air. Like, we're celebrating the end of our marriage in a sense because we're staying good friends. And Michael Knowles at Daily Wire said, Muniz deleted the bizarre video of him and his wife dancing to celebrate their divorce, but he reposted the same nauseous text. This is the most offensive part of liberal, quote, morality. It's not enough that we tolerate their sin and vice. They demand that we celebrate it. And actually, Frankie Muniz responded to him. He said,
wow,
it wasn't to celebrate our divorce. Far from it. We grieved our divorce beyond anything you can imagine. It was to celebrate the fact we're both adults and can handle it like adults moving forward amicably. Everyone is just used to the hideous mudslinging a lot of couples do at the end of a relationship. So they don't know how to take it when two people are cordial.
No, that quote right there, it's just because we're both adults and we can both handle it. You know who can't handle it? Your child. You know who's not an adult making a consensual decision? Your child. Like, that's his mom. That's his dad. That's who he built his life around, is you guys being in one home together. And this blows up his world. That's what Andrew Clavin always says. And it's just the best way to phrase like what a divorce does. You know, I think of my two children where it's like they've built their whole lives on this idea that they have a house and in their house is their mom and their dad and we all are together. And it's like, it's not perfect, but this is what we grow up as. And if one of us would just leave and say, well, now we have a separate house and now you have to go over here part time and over here part time, that would literally blow up their world. Everything's different. Everything changes. They don't have a home anymore. They have like different places that they're traveling back and forth to. And if you love somebody so much enough to write this lovely post like, oh, she, what a beautiful person and how much respect I have for them, then it's not worth it. You know, that's so crazy. And it's a trend on TikTok. I've actually seen recent TikToks before I saw the Frankie Muniz post where, you know, it'll be like there was this couple and they were sitting in a parking lot together and they're like laughing and goofing around. And she said, you know, you're co-parenting well when this is what we do in our free time. So it's like the parents who are now divorced, but they're hanging out as best friends when they're not with their kid. And it's like, wow, I'm really glad that you get the free time and the fun time with your spouse, not in front of your child where it should be. And they have to deal with you guys being separated, but you don't have to. Like, it's just one of the most selfish things I've ever seen.
Yeah. Katie wrote a tweet about this. She said, lots of flowery language about continuing to co-parent together and ending this chapter. But the truth is, your divorce is devastating your son. You can't have the same teamwork if you're not in the same house. You won't have the same nearness with him if he's living apart from you half of the time. Have you seen these things where people are breaking down how much time you actually get with your parents and your siblings? Like, by the time people have said, you know, even let's say you're in your 30s and your parents are in their 50s, you're basically, the amount of time you're going to spend with them is down to like what, 20% left of their life. Or it's like, you know, you could calculate it in hours how much time you have left with these people on the planet. And now you're taking a little kid. I don't know. He looks like he's like 5 years old or something like that. And now you're having his time with mom and dad. That's best case scenario is 50-50. Now you have to think about, you've got one parent, they're acting or they're working or he's racing. You're going to build a business together, continue to build a business together. You're going to co-parent. Why? And it's amicable and you deeply love each other and you care about each other and your son is so important. That's where it's hard, I think, for people to see, why can't you make it work? Why can't you go to counseling if you need some help with communication or I've fallen out of love? What's crazy is these things are malleable. Your affection for someone, your attraction to them, especially because you had it at one point really strongly and very deeply. I think people maybe going into marriage don't think that there are going to be some ebbs and flows, especially with children, with working apart, etc. That it's going to require probably a lot more intentionality, time spent together, deep emotional connection, prioritizing each other. And instead, they think we're just going to go about our life and we're building a business. We have kids. And you know what? We're still deep friends, but I've fallen out of love with you. Is one of these people in love with someone else? You know, what's the deal? And if it's not the case that there's been something crazy, abuse, adultery, etc., I don't understand why you're shredding your kid's life. Is it so you can go date other people? You know, it doesn't make sense. Then, you know, live as friends and get through a season where and that attraction comes back or forms into something deeper. It's not just, you know, the same way you felt when you were dating. And I'll read this one too. Josh from Them For Us wrote, "Divorce is the death of a family. No matter how flowery the language the adults use, the child's world will be ripped apart. They'll have two homes, like houses, but they will have no home at all. They will compete with new spouses and children for love. It's sometimes necessary, divorce, though this one doesn't seem to be, but it's always a tragedy."
Yep, 100%. If you're excited to co-parent, you don't need a divorce. Like, that's it right there. Like, you know, divorce, and in the most extreme cases, you're not excited to co-parent. In fact, if you're getting divorced because your husband's beating on you, you probably shouldn't let your children near that man. He's unsafe and he should be in jail. And like, it's to feel like your child is fully safe and fully capable in another person's hands, you should not be leaving that person. And so, you know, another thing that I think about often, I read this stat years ago and it's always stuck with me, but any married couple who reports being unhappy, if they stick with the marriage within 5 years, they report being happy again. Like you said, it ebbs and flows. And it's like, you know, I think about my parents. I talk about this online all the time. I don't obviously go into much detail because it's not like, it's not my marriage, but, when I was younger, my parents actually almost got divorced. It was very close. They even separated for a little while. It was very awful. And, you know, my dad, it like flipped a switch in him and he realized like, I'm about to lose everything and it wasn't worth it for him. And so he completely changed. And I mean, genuinely changed, not like, oh, I'm just going to say what I need to say to get my wife back. Like his whole character just completely flipped and he's been that person since. And it's obviously been like what, 35 years or something since all that happened, or 30 years. And they worked it out and their marriage has come out stronger because of it. And I can't tell you how much that's impacted me as somebody who's married, just knowing like, well, if my parents can work through it, I know I can work through it. And seeing how it's impacted my kids to be able to go like, oh, I'm going to go to Mimi and Papa's house and go hang out with them together. Instead of it's like, oh, I'm going to go to Mimi's house and her step grandpa, and I'm going to go to, you know, Papa's house and step granny, you know, all these things where it's like the house is not divided. It's one grandparents and, you know, and all of us benefit from that. And so, yeah, it's like one of those things where people, I hate when people say like, oh, I wish that my parents had gotten divorced. And it's like, you just don't. Like, I used to say that as a kid and then I grew up, and then like, you got to grow up out of that, you know, like, yeah, in a moment, things can be really difficult, but you don't know what divorce is and what it brings. And if a married couple can work through something who has kids, it's so worth it because it's such a benefit for the kids. And again, disclaimer, I mean, genuinely work through it. I'm not saying like, because so many people will say, oh, well, if they didn't get divorced, then they're just going to live up in a household where everyone's screaming at each other and it's really awful. And it's like, yeah, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about putting in the hard work and genuinely changing. So that makes me really sad for Frankie's kid because he deserves both parents.
Yeah, when people say, I wish I was raised by two dads. My parents were divorced. They're saying, I wish I didn't endure the things that I endured from my mom and dad or my single mom or single dad or whatever. But my response is always, well, then don't you wish your mom and dad had been healthy and figured it out and put you first?
Isn't right. Like, if we're making wishes, what do you...
Oh, I wish I had been split time between, you know, you have an abusive parent and your parents get divorced. Now you're 50-50. And you're with that parent without the protective parent with you now. I mean, so what are you wishing for, right? This was an interesting comment. Someone said, why are there so many cringe religious replies to this post? An amicable separation with a commitment to evolving the family dynamic is such an obviously positive outcome for a difficult situation. And all these idiots act like they know what's best for complete strangers. First of all, It doesn't have to be religious. You don't have to say anything religious.
Mm-hmm.
And saying this is an obviously positive outcome based on what? Based on the fact that this now will have a series of relationship and breakups probably with their parents. Like, Frankie Muniz is a rich, talented, famous, like, attractive guy. She seems like an attractive woman. Do you think they're, like, never going to date again? There's not going to be any other adults in and out of this kid's home, and siblings, half-siblings, et cetera, on and on and on. So this is, divorce is not the final separation or hardship. It is a beginning of a new series of hardships that mostly the kid will have to experience. Because it's hard for adults to, like, partner up and break up. That'll happen, dating, get your heart broken, et cetera. It's, like, magnify that. For a child, we have stories where people get attached to their dad's girlfriend who was so sweet and she really cared about me. And I have these memories of her cooking with me. And then all of a sudden she just didn't come back. That's it. And kids are just supposed to deal with this and be considered resilient.
That is so great. I my older sister had a boyfriend that she dated for, like, I don't know, 7 years, and they broke up, and I was so devastated. And I was like, you weren't my boyfriend. But it felt like a brother to me. And then, like, you just never see that person again. And it just feels so wrong. And, like, I cannot imagine how magnified that is with children, where it's like, you see them as a motherly figure, because in that house, there is no mom anymore. And you're replacing it. And I have friends who grew up with step parents that they were, again, temporary step-parents. And then whenever they divorced, they never talked to that kid again. And that is so mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just trying to... It looks like a lot of the comments are pretty negative in the sense that they're not supporting the divorce. We need to stop trying to sugarcoat divorce. You just turn your poor kid's whole world upside down. This person said for the next few years, it's like, no, for the rest of your life. Because we talk about this when your parents get divorced when you're older, even adults whose parents get divorced, called gray divorce, it fractures your family dynamic. Yes. Whose house am I going to for Christmas? I have to navigate their dating relationships. I have to navigate. I had family members remarry, and it was from being a widow or a widower, you know, so it wasn't divorce, but even just remarrying someone who has kids and grandkids of their own, it creates such an interesting family dynamic, especially sharing a house, all the belongings, the inheritance of, like, where do those belongings go when one of the members of that marriage, that remarriage, dies, things like that. So,
yep.
I think that's all the time we got. Thanks for joining us, everyone. We love going through the comments with you, just talking about the things we see online and breaking it down for you. See you next time.
See ya.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.